Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome to the NIDS View of 2026. It's a production of the NIDS Podcasting Network, your 2026 resource for understanding deterrence around the world. I'm Jim Petrosky, president and co-founder of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, and today, Curtis and I will be discussing the implications of the capture and arrest of Nicolas Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores, and analyzing how it relates to deterrence. As a reminder, the views of the hosts and the guests are their own. Curtis, are you ready?
What a way for the start of 2026. Happy New Year, everyone.
There you go.
My gosh. You know, in the show prep, Jim always talks about it, so show prep. And show prep, we're like, hey, should we talk about Venezuela? Everybody else is talking about Venezuela. You know, should we talk? And I felt like, and I think we agreed, yeah, we should probably talk about Venezuela. But what we're going to talk about, I think, in this is, what are the implications on deterrence writ large as we look at this issue? Never mind the politics. And although that sometimes
is too short.
At least some of that plays. Yeah. Obviously, we're not a politically charged, if you will, podcast. But politics plays a role in all of this. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, what we really need to talk about, I think, is, you know, what is the U.S. and the greater – and the world and the region going to garner out of this significant victory? So if you as the listener are listening or are hoping that we'll give you some analysis as to how great the insertion of Delta Force was and in the – what was it, the 88 minutes of yep. in and out and all, you're not going to get that here.
It was great, though.
It was great, and you know, a massive round of applause, and what the administration did to execute this mission, phenomenal, right? We think mm-hmm. about the bombs in Iran, now Delta Force in Venezuela. The military is just operating in a phenomenal manner, a high degree of professionalism. I got all that. Now that does translate, Jim, into significant deterrence. Repercussions, and I would say good ones.
How is that so there, Curtis?
Well, because this really drives fear, right? It drives fear in our adversaries to say, yeah, maybe I'm not going to mess around with that. Maybe staying a status quo power is the better thing to do, because I don't want to rile up the United States. And by default, you know, the president of the United States and his desire to have action to make change and do the things that is out there in his national security strategy and in other goals he has. And so what we're seeing today here as we do this podcast, which is just a few days into the new year, obviously post Venezuela, is sort of you know, what the world is reacting on all of this. And I'm particularly interested in how is the world reacting in and around Venezuela? How is the world reacting in Europe and Asia Pacific? And how is the UN reacting? And because those are probably the areas that we want to most influence as we seek to shape the world around us, which is one of the roles of deterrence. So that's what I think is going to be interesting as we get through this.
Yeah, Curtis, one of the things I thought was really interesting when I started thinking about this is that, you know, this is like really signaling that we are, you know, coherent in what we think. We are strategic in the way we think. And if nothing else, you cannot deny that there's clarity in how we look at general deterrence in our hemisphere. And there's no ambiguity about where we stand. I mean, you can't question it. And ambiguity is good in some places. But in this case here, I think that, you know, it holds that the United States position on Venezuela and, you know, other, narco terrorism. Thank you. Yeah. Narco terrorism and and other country intervention in our hemisphere. I think all of that is very, very clear from this action, which I don't think until today was very clear for many years, because we didn't really take a solid stance on those kind of activities. Probably back, maybe Panama probably would be the previous time in which we said, not in our backyard. It's a responsibility of the United States. And I think that's a good thing when you're clear in communicating where you stand. What do you think, Curtis?
Well, I think this is a different form of NIMBYism, right? Not in my backyard-ism. We're not going to have this kind of behavior in our backyard. We talk about, sort of this being the Monroe Doctrine renewed. There's some political hay about the Donroe Doctrine and all that, and that's all fun to deal with. But when we think about the Monroe Doctrine, just to take an academic moment here with our audience, quoting the 1823 Monroe Doctrine, so this is 200 years of policy, right? And it says, quote, "We owe it, therefore, to candor and to the amicable relations existing between the United States and those powers to declare that we should consider any attempt on their part to extend their system to any portion of this hemisphere as dangerous to our peace and safety. With the existing colonies and dependencies of any European power, we have not interfered nor shall interfere." Essentially, the Monroe Doctrine stated that we don't want European powers. Now, this extends even beyond European powers, right? China, Russia, etc. In our hemisphere. And the trade-off would be is that we'll stay out of your business. Well, that didn't necessarily hold because of the, until we were sort of drug into World War I. And then idealism begins to rein in the realpolitik, so to speak. And now all of a sudden, American interventionism became sort of the rule of thumb, specifically post World War II, and beyond the spreading of democracy and so forth. And as we look at this, I want to add one last moment in our academic clarity, and that is in 1904, Theodore Roosevelt, arguably the last realist president prior to President Trump, in December of 1904, included something in what they often refer to by the history observers as the Roosevelt Corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, and it says that all this country desires is to see the neighboring country stable, orderly, and prosperous. Any country whose people conduct themselves well can count upon our hearty friendship. If a nation shows that it knows how to act with reasonable efficiency and decency in social and political matters, if it keeps order and pays its obligations, it needs fear no interference from the United States. Chronic wrongdoing, or an importance which results in a general loosening of ties to civilized society, may, in America as elsewhere, ultimately require intervention by some civilized nation, and in the Western Hemisphere, the adherence of the United States to the Monroe Doctrine may force the United States, however reluctantly, in flagrant cases of such wrongdoing or impotence, to the exercise of an international police power. It's as if Teddy Roosevelt is the president today, right, with this kind of statement and in observation when we look at what were the threat vectors, if you will, coming out of Venezuela, right? And I want to get your thoughts on this, Jim, because never mind all this issue about, the arrests of Maduro and these sorts of things and the legitimacy of his presidency and whether or not he stole an election and all this. That's the politics that we're not interested in right now. What I would argue here is that when we think about the threat to America, its sovereignty, and the good orderliness that Roosevelt was talking about in our own hemisphere, in our backyard, right? Mm-hmm. there, I see these as several things. Two of them were vectors of what we might refer to in modern day society as irregular warfare being conducted against the United States. And this is generally the conducting of narco-terrorism and drug trafficking through the Cartel of the Suns and other support of that world. I see that as a weapons of mass destruction warfare sort of thing. And then, of course, the irregular warfare of using transnational gangs, the Tren de la Ragua and others, Venezuelan types coming to the United States and sort of raising hell here in the United States. The third vector is the hosting of Russia, China, Iran, Hezbollah, and other sort of nasties that the U.S. does not get along with right now, that we view as geopolitical adversaries, or at least at the, you know, the competitors, and giving them a platform, a landing point, a foothold in Latin America, on the north side of Latin America,
yes.
One that can create, you know, mere minutes of ballistic missile flight and cruise missile flight directly to the United States is something that we cannot tolerate. Think Cuban Missile Crisis in, you know, 2030. That's a real possibility had this relationship within Venezuela continued to foster. And then finally, the fourth threat vector that was a real problem is the illegal trafficking of sanctioned oil. And we see this now with the they're seizing tankers in the open ocean and these sorts of things. But doing business in the black market, using shadow fleets, ship-to-ship transfers, and other sorts of things. This flouting of the rules-based international order, I think, is something that the United States should not tolerate anymore. And so it's interesting to me how so many in the world are reacting to this as if the taking of Maduro, so to speak, and bringing him to justice was somehow a violation of some sort of international law. Yet the reality is they've been violating international law for years. That oil has been sanctioned since 2019, and it was continued to be sanctioned over the Biden administration. So it's a bipartisan sanctioning. And yet, no one until now decided to do anything against it. So the rules-based international order either means something or it doesn't. And so what we see here now is realism taking hold. And I think this is the matter. And so when we think about Roosevelt talking about keeping order, paying obligations, and avoiding chronic wrongdoing. That's kind of what the U.S. sort of held the Venezuelan leadership, I use in quotes, to account for.
Well, you talk about the rules-based order, and, you know, you don't get order without putting some energy into creating that order. You know, if everyone was just let to do their own thing, you would have no order. I mean, that's what happens. People, organizations, countries don't just invoke their own order. We invoke our order for our own interest as well. Sure. And we have our own order, you know, our law enforcement, et cetera. You know, but back to the deterrence concept, you know, order in our hemisphere and implications to our hemisphere, you know, this whole move, you know, rhetorically ties back to the Cuban Missile Crisis, in my view, but what we're doing now is since 1962. Yeah, it was back when I was born. Actually, just a couple months before I was born. Imagine that. What we've done now is we've added credibility to that action.
Yes.
Which credibility, in my opinion, especially with a longstanding doctrine, no one's ever pulled it away. You know, it's been many years for people to say, well, the Monroe Doctrine, you know, let's undo it. No one has done that.
That's right.
All the naysayers, they've not pulled it back until they find this one instance when we add credibility to it and in our interest. And the other piece, you can see that connection when you look at the U.S. Strategic Command news briefs came out just today. One of the quotes was that it sent a blunt message to to Beijing about the limits of its influence in a region that Washington treats as its own. I find that very interesting. Like, yes, we treat this as our own. Not that we're, you know, I know the naysayers are going to say, oh, we're taking over. I've heard this already. Oh, we're going to go down there and conquer Venezuela. We're not doing that. But it is in our region and it is in our interest. And we've put valuable money, you know, blood, you know, and courage into this this country in order to return it back to a prosperous, peaceful area. We're not looking for war, at least what I'm saying. Now, the problem, well, let me just go. The one of the things that naysayers do, and I do think we have to be very careful in the way we word it, is that people talk about the rules erosion and are like, well, you know, here we go. We argue that, you know, China and Russia, they don't understand the rules-based order. But understand there's two sides of that rule. There's rules and enforcement of the rules, okay? We are enforcing the rules that were in place. And as you said, over many, many different administrations in our country, but many administrations in many other countries that could have come about and said, you know, these sanctions on oil, you know, and coming from Venezuela, these could be changed. Nobody changed them because they realized the impact it would have had they done that. Now we're enforcing what was put into place. This is good. This is rules. You know, if my grandkids come over here and, you know, they were here earlier today, we just got out of a big holiday. My grandkids are at my house all the time. But if they come over here and start knocking things over and bringing in their muddy, snowy shoes and everything else, and I don't enforce that, it's not because I'm a mean grandpa. It's because I'd like to have a little bit of order in my house while things are going down. And here we see it. And not to make this a childish thing, but it is true. You have to have someone enforcing it as Teddy Roosevelt, as you pointed out, did. But I want to catch another piece of what you said and just hear a little bit about that. And that is that, you know, when we talk about Beijing and its influence here, one of the big influences over energy availability. In fact, a lot of the breakdown in the rules was because of the sanctions on oil and breaking the sanctions and, you know, moving oil and around, which is a great commodity for Venezuela to have. I wished I had their oil in my backyard because, you know, it would be valuable to me. I don't think you'd find a U.S. citizen say, wow, I wish we didn't, you know, I'd hate for us to have that oil. Not that we're going to take it, but it's a valuable resource and it's what they have to work with. And so I think that, you know, we can look at the pinch that's going to have on China because they've been sanction evading and also on Russia, bringing oil prices down, taking that away for them to continue their operations in Ukraine. And again, why? Because we want to keep, you know, the conflicts in a controllable lower state or even get rid of those conflicts so they don't escalate to something bigger. And so you've got to do something. You can't just let it seethe and work. Everybody knows that. If you don't solve a problem, it gets worse and worse and worse, and eventually it becomes a crisis. Deterrence is about putting enough fear in the adversary's mind that they don't want to take it to that level. And we're doing that in this action, in my view. Your comments, Curtis?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of lessons learned for the world out of this that I think are worthy of contributing to deterrence moving forward. In addition to this idea that the Monroe Doctrine plays, right? It still exists and these sorts of things. But what we've done here is, you know, we'll eventually fully excommunicate or repel our big adversaries out of Venezuela, right? And removing that foothold, you know, we've heard a number of occasions now that, in talking about energy, that that Venezuela has the largest oil reserves in the world, and has maybe one of the largest gold reserves in the world, and not to mention many other critical elements that has been much in the news these days because we were trying to find ways around China's market. So there's a huge American interest in having a stable, friendly Venezuela, as we did prior to Chavez when he was voted into office. I'll stress that it points out to the world that no leader is untouchable. All right. If you're a criminal, if you are a problem, no leader is untouchable. I think it also reminds the world that drug dealing, narcotics, this is a form of weapons of mass destruction. You know, and many will argue with me over the fringes. Don't email me. I'm not interested. The president, though, just declared fentanyl a weapons of mass destruction here over the last few weeks.
Curtis, didn't you write something about that?
I did. I wrote a fantastic article in 2023 about the need to declare fentanyl as a national security issue. Again, another event here where we at NIDS are a bit ahead of our time in the way it's being actionized now. So this idea, we know that there's more fentanyl being captured on the open border before the election of President Trump than we would have ever expected that could kill more Americans than any massive laydown in a nuclear attack in the Cold War. I mean, it is a real threat. And without all the destructive boom that goes with it. It also tells the world that America will act if it feels directly threatened. Yep. And that while this administration and in NSS, I pointed it out in my recent article analyzing the 2025 NSS, that it skews anti-interventionism. But to understand that what happened here in Venezuela is not interventionism as talked about in the 2025 NSS, right? This is about war prevention, in a sense, and maybe I'll get into that in a little bit more. So despite anti-interventionism inclinations in this administration, they're not afraid to pull the trigger, so to speak, if directly threatened. It further proves the fecklessness of the United Nations. Full disclosure, listeners, I am not a big fan of the United Nations. They've not prevented any wars. They've really not done a very good job of ensuring the rules-based international order. And as evident by the amount of criticism levied in that building against the U.S. Versus the amount of criticism that they don't give any of the world's violators or offenders regarding the rules-based international order. And then finally, I think what has happened here is the removal of the next potential Cuban Missile Crisis. Again, I mentioned earlier, Venezuela is almost as close as Cuba. Obviously it's a little bit farther away than Cuba, but it's still pretty close. It's in the northern coast of South America. It's rocket flight times to the heart of the United States is mere minutes. And the idea that Russia and China would have continued to dig in like ticks on a dog, and bringing in weapons of mass destruction overtly or covertly would have created a real crisis for the United States in the coming years, and expect to that would have happened probably around the time of a Taiwan crisis, as a way to coerce us into inaction in that world. And so what we've done is we've sort of removed that possibility. And I think that has a real effect. Again, deterrence is measured is difficult to prove because it is measured in a metric of what doesn't happen. Right. And so when we talk about wars of prevention, I'm not talking preemption. This would be maybe I don't want to call it a war. It wasn't a war, but it was an act of prevention, and that the ramifications of that small act, if it can reinstate a stabilized government that is friendly to America and not hostile to America, then presumably it will be less of a threat to America going forward. And America needs fewer threats, not more threats. So those are just a couple things that I think was a benefit and a contributor towards deterrence. And I think in the long run, this will be stabilizing for the most part with regard to removing those threats. And so a question I want to ask you, Jim, as we move, as I hand the mic back to you, is that there is a counter argument that this act was destabilizing because what it has done is has set a precedent that will allow sort of China and President Xi to say, well, you know, you did it in Venezuela, I'm going to do it in Taiwan. The argument of this is my backyard, we're not going to have, that's a threat to us, these sorts of arguments. And I'm curious what your thoughts are. Is that a valid risk?
Well, anytime you do anything, you have risks associated with it. That's the problem, is you become, you know, if you look at every risk in any action, then you basically become risk stymied, I think, is one of the words that are used. So let me go back. First of all, I'll catch that in a second. But before that, I just want to add one thing, and that is, and it does relate to the spectacular work of our special forces and our military in doing this. Not only did it show that we would do something, but we did do something. And we can do it on our grounds, not on someone else's. And I mean, that was the big fear when we had the helicopter go down in the Iranian
in 79.
And that was the big risk then, because it showed us as weak. And as soon as we showed up as weak, everyone wanted to jump in and jump on the U.S. And this shows that we are strong. And that strength presents a deterrent. And I just wanted to highlight that. The second piece, I'll get to your answer in just a second. But the second piece is regarding narco-terrorism, because we don't have time in this podcast today to talk about it. But there's a huge economics issue here. Even if narco-terrorism, even if you ignore the fact, and I can't believe you can, but if you decide you're going to ignore the fact that hundreds of thousands of Americans are affected by the narco-terrorism that goes on in our country, the reality is the narco-terrorists are getting money, and they're using that money for what? To just buy vacations and watch more YouTube channels? I mean, come on. That money is going into regimes who hope to cause us harm. And by reducing that, we are reducing their capability of doing that. And again, you know, we talk about, you know, nuclear weapons or anything else, but any program or stealing or buying or whatever, nuclear materials or et cetera, that's an economic transaction for the most part in the end. And we take that off the table when you take those dollars that are flowing back to those organizations that wish us harm. And we've got to see that as part of our actions in the protection of our country as we move forward. Now, it doesn't mean you obliterate everyone that does everything that you don't like, but you do for those that present an existential threat to you. Okay, now on to this concept, because I agree, any action, when you move into a country, we've seen this, but there's a historic context I'll bring up, and but when you move into a country and you remove its president, regardless of who it is, if they have their thumb on the people or whether the most benevolent leader, when they are removed in this fashion or any other fashion, there is a power vacuum that every country will go through. Somebody, you know, I'm going to dig at our politicians, but face it, our politicians want to be in charge of something. That's why they're in that business. And politicians and leaders want to be leaders and politicians, and they want to be in charge of something. And when you take that power out of the hands of somebody, somebody's going to step in. And we saw this in Iraq. When we went into Iraq and we took out the leader, we had all this vying for power, vying for strength, and the chaos that it created. And it was part of what I think we didn't see. And we also didn't see the chaos result of what happened in North Korea. They saw the head of a state taken out and they said, oh my gosh, that's what the United States is going to do. If they don't like us, we're nuking up. And we have to put that onto our plate as being an important aspect. So when people say, oh no, what's going to happen from a destabilization standpoint? I like that people look at it from that standpoint. That's the first step. Now, the second step in that is, what are we going to do about it? We have to take it from a realist standpoint that there are people that want to move into Maduro's situation and maybe use his leverage to do even worse or make bigger plans, or may do things more covertly, or may you know, threaten their people. There are all kinds of things that happen. So the follow through on this action is what I have, I always say about deterrence. You've heard me before. You know, it's easy to figure out how many nuclear weapons it takes to deter somebody. Just go back to 1967 and say, how many nuclear weapons did we have then? And how many nuclear wars do we have? Well, we had none. So that's the number. Okay. Well, we also had a different number in 73. My point is, the past is easy to predict. The future is hard to predict. And the United States, you know, the action is one thing, but the next step is, what do we do next? I'm very curious where the administration is. And this isn't condemning or anything else, mm-hmm. but I'm very curious to watch how this happens. And let me step back way back. This last year, because I'm a scientist and engineer, I haven't spent a lot of time in the deterrence world. This is a shout out to my science and technology folks. For many years, I've worked the science technology side. I was in the Army. I understood fighting. I understood the tactical and strategic side of this, but I never really understood where the war came from. What happened in war? And I've gone back and I looked at the Civil War in the United States. I've looked at the Spanish-American War. I've finished World War I. I've been reading books about the start of these wars, World War II. And I've looked at how wars develop. And what happens is that actions are taken and then we don't take the next step. I mean, you see, and you can look at what we did in North Africa before World War II. We really didn't. We went in, we cheered, we were done. It's like, no, you weren't done yet. Okay, there's a lot more to do. Okay, we have to take each action with a follow up, and a follow up has to be in our interest. And I hope that that's where we're heading. And the future will tell. And that's what's going to let us know whether the glut of oil that's probably going to hit the market, the reduction in prices, it'll be great for us at the gas pump, but also will give Russia an opportunity to buy cheaper oil because the oil in the market is going to go down if the Venezuelan oil goes out. If a leader steps into a position that we don't like, are we just going to extract another until we get what we like? I don't know. That is because we didn't remove the leader, by the way. I probably misspoke here. We didn't remove a leader because we didn't like them. We removed the leader because we had a bounty on this person. There were sanctions against them. The world condemned him. And we had a legal action to bring him home. I mean, that's what the administration says. And it's backed up with real information. So I want to know what the follow-up is. And so when you ask me my opinion on that, my opinion is I don't know what the follow-up is. I'm not as involved in what makes a country, you know, fall or fail or succeed as much as the diplomats do, but we do need to do something. We can't just shake our hands and say, hurrah, we're done. Okay, let's go back to MTV or whatever else mm-hmm. the current thing is. MTV was my generation's, walk away from it. But you get my drift. So what do you think about that, Curtis?
Well,
from a scientist engineer standpoint.
Well, I think it's, from that, it's just a matter of logic. The problem is in geopolitics, the logic train is often convoluted and complex, but it also is simple, and sometimes it's the simplicity that is the hardest to understand, because it's the hardest to believe, and one of those is this idea that an American invasion, that's the wrong word, an American extraction of the Venezuelan dictator. Is somehow going to embolden the Chinese to want to move forward with a retaking of Taiwan is no more valid than the argument that America's invasion of Iraq in 2003 sort of kind of gave the permission to Putin to invade Ukraine in 14 and again in 22. What happens is that this is a constant idea that adversaries around the world only act in reaction to us. And this is simply untrue. I can't be any clearer to all of those people driving on 495 around the Beltway. Nations act in their own interests, regardless of how we act. And often what happens is It is our failure to react or our failure to act in the first place that allows their actions to occur. In other words, what I'm saying is that our behavior has little influence on their behavior in these sorts of circumstances. The goal of deterrence is to put forth behavior to impact and change behavior. And so what happens here is that when we're conducting a defensive maneuver, right, this is a reach, this is sort of a reaction to what has been a long-term, multi-year attack on the United States through these different irregular warfare vectors. Mm-hmm. And violations of international behavior and so forth. And so this is the reaction to that. This isn't the start of something new. An invasion of Taiwan is not a reaction. It is the start of something new, right? So if you can grasp the differences in there, there's little, that little Taiwan is going to do to sort of scare at least in a realist manner, China, right? There's the balance of power there is very difficult for Taiwan to influence. It's too small. But it is the ideological things of Taiwan that threaten China, right? They can't see a Chinese influenced society that is democratized and thriving. That would be bad for the Chinese Communist Party to have that, to consistently and continue to have that exemplar that, you know, would be open to their population. That's something that they don't want. Because what is the number one interest of the Chinese Communist Party? And that is securing the Chinese Communist power. Mm-hmm. So again, in this sense here, what we're talking about is largely a domestic population in Venezuela that seems to be cheering and celebrating what has occurred. So it's not about, it's not against the people. America always says, we are not at war with the people. We are at war with the leaders, or we have a grievance with the leaders. Maybe we do this in Iran all the time, and so forth. So the bottom line here is that nations behave in their own best interests. The United States just did that. China thinks it's doing that. Russia believes it's doing that. All these countries believe that they're doing that. And so the trick here is how do you negotiate, right, these different interests when they become conflicts mm-hmm. of interest? And conflicts of interest, when they bump up against one another, can result in a shooting conflict. And so this, I guess, is sort of what we see in modern geopolitics. You know, if you don't talk, you're fighting, and if you're fighting, then it's difficult to start talking. So deterrence really helps in this sense to ensure that there's more room to talk until such time that you can no longer influence. That's when deterrence fails, the shooting begins. So, and I do appreciate your Yogi Berra sentiment that the past is easy to predict. That is very good, and this is why the U.S. is trying to change its future by looking at its past. There's been a lot of behavior that we have done that has encouraged and fostered this kind of threat that we have to face. And at some point in time, if you don't act when you have to lance the boil at some point, otherwise it becomes bigger and more painful and harder to lance, and a more expensive insurance, you know, payment. And
I hope no one's eating during this.
Sorry
podcast
about that. Forgive my vision there. The bottom line here is that again. We've seen some real challenges. I'll leave you, Jim, with one final thought here, and then I'll give it to you to close us out. And that is, we always, in the deterrence world, there is a strategic paradox that we must always remember. And that is that too much restraint weakens deterrence, and too much intervention can increase instability. So you got to find that happy medium. Mm-hmm. And I think what we're doing as a nation in the United States and its behavior in the world right now is we have found that sweet spot. And so I'm hoping we can continue to walk that. That isn't to say we have more work to do. We do. And I encourage our readers to look at our nuclear posture review that we have put out for 2026, because that is one area of America's policies that we need to do better in, is increasing our nuclear deterrent. But when it comes to our behavior, I think we have found that sweet spot.
Well, thanks, Curtis. Yeah, this has been great discussion, and in the show prep, I'll admit that we weren't sure where this talk was going to go. I think we got something out there for our listeners. We'll be interested in your feedback and your comments, both to NIDS at thinkdeterrence.com as well as our YouTube channel. And I'll have to admit, Curtis brought up the show prep up front. So what I really wanted to talk about the show prep is a CBS article about orcas coming up in the Puget Sound with dead salmon on their heads like hats. But Curtis didn't think that was could be turned into anything about deterrence.
I don't see any deterrence in that, other than I'm not swimming with the orcas.
There you go. So so with that in mind, I want to thank our audience for joining us and sticking with us. And I, again, ask that you... you step out and talk to your friends about our podcast, about the many things that NIDS is doing, our seminars, our HUSI seminars on Fridays. Join in those. Come listen to our podcast. Get our podcast out there. We're growing every week. And as my last Yogi Bear comment to all of you, when you get to the fork in the road, take it. Have a good day. And remember, think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.